the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Matt Broughton, Senior Editor at ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to be joined by this week's special guest, who is Harriet Kingerby, co-founder of the Conscious Advertising Network. Hello to you, Harriet.
Hello, Matt.
Pleasure to have you. And delighted to also be joined by Rachel Smith, co-founder and CEO of ExchangeWire. Hello to you, Rachel.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Harriet. Delighted to be invited back onto the MadTech Podcast. It's been ages.
Absolute pleasure to have you as always. We'll dive straight into the first news story, which is Meta has introduced a new function that will allow users to opt out of receiving highly personalized ads on its platforms. Users of Facebook and Instagram will be able to submit a form objecting to use of specific data for advertising, such as the content they previously engaged with. Meta will then assess each application. Users whose requests are accepted will only receive targeted ads based on broader categories, such as general location and demographic. The change will only apply to users in Europe, where Meta received a €390 million fine from the Irish Data Protection Commission for making consent for behavioural targeting part of the platform's terms of service. Meta has now switched to using legitimate interest to justify its targeted advertising and has reportedly said that it anticipates that it will make more changes off of the back of the DPC ruling. So my first question to you guys is this move a win for user privacy or simply Meta covering its back following the fine? Harriet, let's start with you.
Great question. Well, I think the core of this and the most important thing here is to think about respect for people and for users. And I think what we're seeing here is, you know, I think the fact that we have to fill in a form or users have to fill in a form and the fact that there is this friction within the process, actually screams to me of not really, really, I think trying to essentially put friction within that process and perhaps to, you know, kind of stop people from exercising their rights to give their consent. You know, if it's a button, it's very, very easy for us to say yes or no. And otherwise, you know, there's only going to be a select few people for whom privacy is an issue that they know a lot about, they care a lot about, who I think are going to do so. As advertisers, it is really important that we, that we do collect proper consent and that we are respectful, because we know that, when users feel like they're taken advantage of or they're not necessarily respected, then we start to lose trust. And when we start to lose trust, we have a problem. So I do think that, although this is interesting and encouraging, it's A, only in Europe, and B, I think the process itself suggests that perhaps, this kind of respect of the user isn't core to those decisions.
Rachel, where do you think Facebook's intentions lie here?
Yes, well, I completely agree with Harriet, and shall I say it a little more bluntly, because maybe I can, which is that, I think Facebook's intentions here are to absolutely protect its advertising business, and they will do that at the cost of, I think, user privacy and respecting consumer choice and control. And I don't think that there's anything about this mechanism that screams we care about the user's experience and we want to put control back into their hands. As Harriet says, it's a form submission which they will, then consider in terms of whether they would actually, grant you the ability to opt out of this targeted advertising. And I can't see that this would satisfy any, sane privacy regulator. It may well be, just one of many steps that Meta might be working on in order to improve the way in which they enable consumers to give consent to using their data for the purposes of advertising. But this just doesn't go... it doesn't even come close to convincing anyone that they actually care about consumer control and consumer and user experience. I also thought, this is a super interesting article because we're just in a period of, I think, advertising and marketing, digital advertising and marketing history, where we're starting to see these cases put forward by privacy regulators and data controllers all over the show, really shaping the way in which digital advertising is going to change over the course of the coming years. And so I feel like we're on the precipice of really significant changes to you know, the way that consumer choice and control is handled and managed. And it won't just be here in Europe that we start seeing these big tech companies have, having pressure put on them to change the way in which they enable people to control the use of their data. What I think is more interesting here is, you know, Meta's alternative to just experiencing regular advertising targeting is something that's a bit more generalized and will perhaps just use a more sort of general geographical location for targeted advertising and something that isn't so specific and detailed. And I would think it'd be, you know, I think it'd be really interesting to see what experience that will give advertisers that are spending money on the platform. Will it actually make that much difference to the success of their campaigns or won't it? And of course, we expect that it will make a huge amount of difference, which is one of the reasons that Meta doesn't really want to put control of this into consumers' hands. But, you know, it's an experiment that advertisers will be wanting to understand, because ultimately if they're spending money on Meta's platform and they're not able to target users in the way that they previously were, they'll be wanting to, you know, to see the difference. So yeah, super interesting article, and I really don't think that it, you know, that Meta cares at all about consumer choice and control.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it shows contempt for the users. Not only do they have to fill in the form, they have to, you know, argue each and every point as to why they think Meta should have that legitimate interest. And it's something that, you know, regulators have already taken a very dim view of. Obviously, we've had investigations by the Italian DPA into TikTok, for example. So yeah, I think it's not necessarily going to play out for Facebook, but kind of building on your point there, Rachel, in terms of how that landscape and how that uncertainty for advertisers in terms of any further action against Facebook, how will, you know, what implications does it have for advertisers, and what's the kind of next stage of advertising on Meta?
I think that's a really interesting question. I'd be fascinated to hear Harriet's point of view on this, but I just think, you know, advertisers will go, will spend money where they feel like they're getting decent return on investment and they're able to prove the efficacy of their marketing and advertising campaign efforts, right? And that's why Meta has been an enormously popular platform, because for a lot of advertisers, it produces really great results. So as soon as those results start degrading, or advertisers are feeling as though there's a bit of opacity associated with where their money's going and how their campaigns are performing, then I think they will vote with their feet and they will find other places to put that budget. But Harriet, I'm sure you've got, you know, an interesting point of view on this.
Well, so when we started the Conscious Advertising Network, we looked at the way that one of the issues that we were looking at was the presence of unsavory content on, you know, various different, on the open web and various different platforms, including Meta's platforms, and the role that advertising has when it appears next to hateful content or disinformation, and the fact that it legitimizes that content to some extent and it funds the environment that content sits in. And I think there have been various campaigns over the years, things like Not to Stop Hate for Profit, for example, where advertisers have attempted to put pressure on Meta to change its policies and to enforce its policies well and better. And, you know, to some extent, we've reached a stage where a lot of advertisers feel like they have to hold their nose and get on with it, because we know that Meta hasn't properly addressed a lot of these issues. And so, you know, and if you look at English languages outside the English language, for example, and if you look at markets such as Kenya or Myanmar, Ethiopia right now, you can see that these platforms are complicit in atrocities. So I think, you know, there is this kind of general growing and, you know, kind of ongoing concern about the platforms and about Meta's platforms and its, you know, and its brand safety. You've also got the kind of rise of competitors and of different places. You've got this kind of antitrust legislation, which is, may or may not be slowing down in everything that's happening in the States right now. So, you know, I think that Meta would do really, really well to start really thinking about how it not only re-engineers its advertising tools, but also the platform itself and the way that it kind of runs things. And I know that, you know, the investment that they've got in the metaverse, and you can't go to an advertising conference without talking about the metaverse. what we don't want is for them to port over the issues that they have currently on the platform into this new space. So I think that this is a really interesting time for Meta and for other platforms and other, you know, and ad tech tools to be really thinking about, you know, kind of like how do we create better policies that ensure that advertisers feel that they can advertise in brand safe environments, that consumers feel like they can exercise more privacy as we have more kind of discussion about these issues. And I completely agree with you, Rachel. It's going to be a really, really interesting time in terms of what comes next.
Yeah. And I think you raise a really good point there as well, Harriet, that actually I also think everybody's becoming more acutely aware of the advertising value exchange. So, you know, advertisers are conscious about where they want to, you know, where they spend their money with respect to brand safety issues, as you've mentioned. But I also think consumers are found in lots of different environments. So I would also question what types of consumers we're finding in a Facebook environment. And I think that is changing from market to market very rapidly and will continue to do so. So, you know, Meta and every other, you know, social media platform really needs to keep on their toes in order to be an environment that attracts a particular type of users that then advertisers want to reach. But the other thing is, I think consumers are becoming so much more conscious of where they're experiencing advertising and what that advertising is telling them. So further to your point, Harry, I do think people will notice much more today than they would have even 5 years ago if they are on Facebook scrolling around in news feeds and nefarious content pops up, or content that just doesn't seem to be, you know, aligned with their values pops up and advertising pops up beside that. I think that really will have an impact on their user experience that maybe they wouldn't have been so consciously tuned into 4 and 5 years ago, because I just think the whole world is talking a lot more about this than ever before. And so in that context, I just think that, you know, Meta not giving users control over their data will eventually become a redundant capability. They just won't be able to do it eventually over time. And the ability for them to really control that is rapidly degrading here in Europe, and I think other markets will follow.
Absolutely. And I think that brings us nicely onto our next story, which sticks with the themes of data in large platforms. The Information Commissioner's Office has fined TikTok £12.7 million for collecting and processing the data of up to 1.4 million children under the age of 13 without consent. The body concluded that the ByteDance-owned company failed to stop under-13s from signing up in violation of its own terms and conditions and did not remove these users from the platform. The penalty comes amid concerns that young people are being exposed to harmful content posted on the app, such as videos relating to self-harm and mental health disinformation. Research from the Centre for Combating Digital Hate suggests that the TikTok's algorithm can push videos related to eating disorders and other disturbing content onto young users within minutes after they sign up. TikTok maintains that it has updated its practices since the ICO probe and that it does not permit the promotion of harmful content. So, Rachel, my question to you here is, what impact could this ruling have on TikTok's future in the UK?
Another super interesting article, right? So, you know, associated with some of the things we've already discussed, but so topical. Could this impact TikTok's future in the UK? Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly bad news for TikTok, right? And, you know, there again seems to be a bit of a groundswell of kind of consumer opinion as well as government and regulatory opinion about the use of TikTok and about how it is controlled and regulated within from the perspective of the Chinese company that owns it, ByteDance, and also from the perspective of how it's managed, controlled and used within various regions and various countries. I don't think that this is heading in a good direction. I don't think that TikTok is at all coming out and being convincing in their statements around how they handle, again, user data, user privacy and sort of protect that user experience. This particular incident seems to have happened despite some of the controls and regulations they've already got in place. So it's actually, you know, happened against their own, you know, regulations and controls, which just seems weird to me. You know, it raises all sorts of questions about how they're policing and containing information within their own platform. We know that the likes of other enormous social media giants like Meta, as we've already discussed, spends a fortune on moderating content and trying to handle how disinformation and harmful content appears on the platform and then is dealt with from there onwards. You'd want to be certain that TikTok is doing, you know, something very similar and, in fact, perhaps exceeding those efforts because of the type of platform that it is, very video-oriented, you know, very, very kind of bite-sized content and appealing to such a wide demographic. It was the platform of the kids a couple of years ago. Now it's widely used by pretty much everyone. It's become the de facto default social media platform. I just think this is bad news for TikTok. I don't think that they're doing enough at all to convince consumers and to convince regulators that they've got the situation under control. And I think it comes off the back of a huge groundswell of, like I said, consumer and regulatory opinion about ByteDance as the Chinese-owning company. And so I feel like it's heading in a not great direction for them. On the other hand, and I'll shut up in a minute, Harriet, let you speak, but on the other hand, I do wonder what it would be like if the government actually banned TikTok in the UK. It sort of feels like a really big step to take and a really big statement to make. And, you know, it very much veers off into censorship territory. And also so many people use the platform. Like, what would that actually be like for, you know, really hooked in users of the platform? So I can't actually imagine that scenario because it just feels so monumental. However, this is a really good example of how they're just not heading off in the right direction at all when it comes to preventing harmful content getting into the hands of users.
Absolutely. Harriet, what are your initial thoughts on this one?
I mean, very much what Rachel said. But also, you know, I think that this is another example of what we see this lag in governance when platforms kind of come to market. So, you know, you'd think that we'd learn that we need these kind of, you know, we need these checks and balances, we need good policies and we need good enforcement and we need transparency about how effective the measures these platforms put in place are, way earlier on than we're getting. And what it seems to be, and it was the same with it was the same with the Meta platforms. It's you know, I mean, I think Twitter's had its own life cycle that's quite different. But like, you know, what we see is these platforms come to market, they get incredibly popular, and then we learn the impacts. Researchers find out the impacts of their recommendation algorithms, of the information environment that they create. And we have a scandal. And unfortunately, that seems to be when governance, you know, kind of gets put in place and those, you know, the organizations start to do it. And we really need the reverse. We need the platforms to come to market with much stronger, ethical kind of considerations and, kind of testing, but also, stronger governance in terms of the policies and the way they enforce them. And so, you know, and just to use an example of that actually before I move on, you know, I think about 5 or 6 years ago, Mozilla did a study into YouTube's recommendation algorithms and found that, you know, they could be used to radicalize young men. Now, that's an extremely harmful side effect of of an algorithm. And now we see this. So I do think it should be a warning because I do, as you said, Rachel, I don't think regulators are, and the public are happy to just go, oh, well, you know, it's a mistake, particularly when it's children's well-being that's at stake. We're starting to see data, and there was this interesting study out this year into the happiness of under 18s and their self-reported mental health. And just the inflection point that changed was when we started kind of habitually carrying phones and using these platforms. And, you know, we have a responsibility to fix that. I know that we are advertisers, we don't run these things, but we are essentially the platform's customers. And so, you know, when we start to think about where we put our media spend and the questions that we ask our partners, I think, you know, we can exert some pressure over this system. And we have already seen it. For example, you know, kind of Google, Pinterest, and quite recently TikTok have introduced climate misinformation policies, for example, that, you know, kind of set a standard for a hot topic issue because of, you know, kind of work and pressure from advertisers. So we know that this can work. And I do think we have a responsibility to, you know, to start asking our partners, what are you doing about this? And I need to see the evidence for what you're doing.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you, Harriet, that none of this is happening in the right order. You know, wouldn't it be refreshing for a social media platform to come to market having already shored up their brand safety, their consumer choice and control, their data privacy, and having thought from a holistic point of view about their proposition, not just their proposition for attracting users to their platform, but their proposition for advertisers, which should be taking all of those things into account, their proposition for protecting users and providing a really good environment for users to, you know, spend time on their platform from the point of view of, you know, of high quality, great content and making sure that they're not, you know, encouraging or fueling disinformation or, you know, heading down rabbit holes that nobody wants to head down. And, you know, that hasn't happened yet in our lifetime, but maybe, again, this is another turning point and we'll start to see that there will be, because there will be at some stage a TikTok competitor. They're enormous at the moment. It's difficult to imagine that, but I'm sure there's already one in China. We've talked about this, you know, over the last couple of months that we don't even know about. And there will be, you know, young people who are working on alternative platforms and alternative environments, because already you're starting to see some really young consumers, further to some of the studies that you mentioned there, Harriet, who don't want to spend time on these social media platforms because they make them feel awful. They make them feel inadequate. They make them feel depressed. They find them, you know, very confronting, aggressive environments. There's lots of bullying and harassment that happens in those environments. And so it may well be that, you know, that as consumers, we start taking control of those platforms, and somebody invents one that is created from the perspective of trying to make sure that all of these things are taken care of first. I think it's a fact of life that government regulators are always slow to catch up. I'd love it if it wasn't like that, but, you know, probably associated with our parliamentary democracy, which is a great thing in so many ways, the way that governments legislate and work, you know, although with the best will in the world, there are many passionate politicians out there that would like to create legislation before the horse has bolted and take things into account from a long-term perspective. That's just not the way that the world works. So it's often that it's catching up afterwards. The legislative environment and the regulatory environment is catching up afterwards. It would be great if it was the other way around. But I do completely agree with Harriet that I think there's going to be a lot more pressure on these platforms to comply. And I don't think anyone will be buying TikTok's response to this particular incident right now. But the other interesting thing, again, always trying to look at it from the other point of view, is, you know, it's interesting that TikTok is readily becoming banned in certain environments. Could you imagine governments and other institutions and organizations doing that with platforms that were American owned or European owned? Like, I do think there is a degree of, you know, possibly, I'm not an expert on Chinese politics, but, you know, possibly warranted xenophobia happening here, where we've got this sort of, you know, suspicion about TikTok because it's a Chinese-owned platform. People are applying quite sort of arbitrary opinions to it. And I'm not saying that's not warranted, but I'm finding it really interesting seeing how that shakes out in comparison to, you know, to these incumbent social media platforms that we've been living with for like nearly 20 years now, where people don't seem to have the same reaction, not to the same extent anyway.
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, this story absolutely terrified the pants off me because sort of, you know, we've desensitized to large numbers in sort of globalized tech. But I kind of looked into that 1.4 million number in terms of the children. And according to UNICEF data, that's 10% of all children in the UK. So it's not unreasonable to suggest that that's kind of, you can extrapolate that to 20%, maybe a quarter of all children under the age of 13 have used TikTok. And obviously, according to the studies we've cited, they could be exposed to harmful content within a period of less than 10 minutes.
So, I mean, it's shocking, right? Yeah. And unacceptable.
Yeah. And kind of building on your point, Rachel, in terms of how we regulate these big tech platforms in the story we've just discussed prior to this one. Obviously, we've looked at Meta and their data practices. So I think rather than looking at it from a kind of China versus the US, you know, versus the Western world, it should be a case of, you know, looking at these platforms. And I think, you know, again, building on your point, Rachel, in terms of the governance, there needs to be more proactive work by government agencies to work with startup tech platforms before they get to the size and scale of TikTok. But yeah, whether that will happen or not with the kind of overall conditions, I think remains to be seen.
But it's a good idea, right? Like, that is exactly what should be happening. There should be a government department, a government agency that is responsible for or takes the lead on working with tech startups around even just simple things like data privacy and how to look after your consumer data and things that you can do and can't do, and making sure all of those things are set up before platforms become well established. Sorry, Harriet, I think you were going to say something then.
No, I think that's, you know, it's, I was coming back to this idea of ethics as a design principle and how you, you know, kind of like, and I think absolutely there needs to be a government intervention to make that happen. I also think that, like you, I think it's a really good point that you made, Rachel, about that, you know, there are young entrepreneurs who are kind of actually saying, no, we're not going to behave like that. You know, I think we've seen groups of people who share Instagram accounts to confuse the algorithms, for example, so that, you know, so that they can't collect too much data about them. They kind of be real is, you know, is exactly about not, you know, kind of being an anti-Instagram and not engaging with that. Arguably, TikTok is a, you know, kind of reaction against the kind of false realities that are shown on Instagram as well. So I think, you know, there is this cycle of evolution, but we've got to work really hard, I think, to make sure that those, you know, data privacy issues, that those, you know, kind of, that we have scrutiny of the of those kind of recommendation algorithms, that we do have transparency about the effectiveness of the things that the platforms do to make the platforms a safer place, you know, from the outset. And if we do that, I think we're going to have a much better place, but we need to get on with it.
We totally do.
100%. And I think that, yeah, I think that sentiment's a nice one to, nice and positive one to end that story on. So we'll move on to the third one of the week. The Association of Online Publishers has called out unscrupulous tech vendors for illicitly using publisher content for contextual advertising. In an open letter published last month, the industry body denounces the practice as intellectual property theft. The AOP argues that data scraping not only deprives publishers of their right to monetize their owned content, but also raises questions around data quality, and claims some vendors are shifting the blame for their actions onto their advertising partners. The body partnered with the Trustworthy Accountability Group to issue an updated brand safety certification with new wording that establishes, and I quote, clearer definitions around publisher data applications. In the letter, the AOP also called on the wider industry to help end the practice by scrutinising verification partners and by participating in cross-industry consultations on the issue. So again, another wide-ranging story here, but my first question to you, Harriet, is what impact do you think data scraping and similar practices have on the health of the overall online advertising ecosystem?
Brilliant. Great question. So I'm going to kind of slightly flip this on its head. Because in order for our advertising to be effective and to you know, really appeal and do what it needs to do, we need it to be in part of a healthy information ecosystem as well. Because one of the biggest problems we've had is that trust in online advertising is low. And that makes it less effective. It makes it more difficult to get our message across and to drive people to do, you know, partake the behaviours we want them to partake in. And so actually having a healthy online information ecosystem is just as important for us as it is for society. Now, we're living in a time where a couple of years ago, I think Lord Putnam described us living in a pandemic of misinformation. We are living in a time when conspiracy theories are completely kind of flourishing. They are sidelining important legislation that's going, you know, or kind of important kind of consultations that are happening around things as mundane as traffic calming. You know, we saw the conspiracy theories that happened around COVID that led to serious harm to people's health. We are living in a time where we have extreme culture wars and, you know, kind of xenophobia and racism that exists in our ecosystems. And we are living in a time when we're trying to solve climate change. And there is huge amounts of confusion. I think 47% of the British public say they don't know what to do about climate change because they're just so confused by the conflicting information out there. So it has never been more important for us to have, and us as advertisers, to invest in quality sources of reporting. We need quality information. We need diverse voices and, you know, voices that represent diverse communities to be part of these really important conversations. And we need all of that because there is a plethora of mis and disinformation out there. There is a plethora of, rhetoric that crosses into hate speech out there. We can find it. I can literally find it by typing the right terms into Twitter right now. And, you know, we to counter that, we need quality reporting, we need diverse voices, and we need all of this to be funded by advertising. Now, as we talked about the data privacy issues, and we've talked about the fact that, you know, we are looking at the future of advertising is looking very, very different, and contextual advertising could play a big part in that. But there is absolutely no point in making this shift if we are going to take more money from publishers, because publishers have already seen a drop in revenue from what's happened over the last 15 years. And it is causing a degradation of our media ecosystems. We, again, similar surveys that have shown that actually, you know, kind of online media has changed the way that it reports in order to get more kind of attention and get more clicks. And that's had some interesting effects. Headlines tend to be more negative or more salacious, for example. We have we'll see things reported in very, very different ways than we did maybe 10, 15 years ago. And so, you know, in all of this, we as advertisers have a huge responsibility because we fund this media ecosystem. And so it's so, so important we think about where our advertisers are going, what partners we're working with, because this is third parties who are, who are doing this on our behalf. And, you know, who many of us use because we, you know, advertising at scale requires working with these kind of partners. But we cannot be just, you know, kind of saying this isn't our problem, our responsibility. And I think the fact that TAG have introduced this, worked with the AFP and introduced and updated their brand safety kind of certificate is really, really important. It is incumbent on all of us to work out how we can make sure that we are, you know, kind of not playing, inadvertently playing a part in this, because it might not have a business impact on us tomorrow, but when the next conspiracy theory comes for us, comes for your brand, comes for your, the leader of your agency, then it will be a problem. The shifts we're seeing in society at the moment are not things that we want to be inadvertently funding or being complicit in, whatever the context.
I mean, brilliantly said, Harriet. I cannot improve on that in any way. I just think everything you said there is so incredibly important, and I would only underscore it by saying for a long time at ExchangeWire, we've been talking about the importance of a fully healthy advertising and marketing technology ecosystem. So that means the technology side of it needs to be just as healthy as the publishing businesses, as the brand, driven advertising businesses, as the advertising agencies and all of the other consultancies and intermediaries that support the industry. So I completely support everything that you've said there. And I guess the other thing that I would add to it, is I really enjoyed this quote from Danny Spears of the Ozone Project that appeared in the Adweek article that covered certainly the AOP's open letter and the update to the brand safety certificate that they've partnered with the TAG Trust and Accountability Group on, where he said there are hundreds of intermediaries who are classifying publisher intellectual property and then are taking it back to market as their own data and using it to compete for ad dollars against the publisher. There is nothing in that sentence that is morally good. Nothing in that sentence. And so I just think if ad tech vendors are undertaking this activity, they really need to check themselves because, you know, there's a lot of ad tech companies out there whose voices we would have absolutely joined with, who were very vocal against the, you know, anti-competitive dominance of some of the well-established ad tech players that were making it very difficult for smaller ad tech companies to compete. Well, this is just an example of some of those ad tech vendors now indulging themselves in anti-competitive behaviour, and it's harming publishers. And for all of the reasons that you just stated, Harriet, it is absolutely not right. So well done to the AOP for publishing their open letter, working together with TAG to update the brand safety certificate, and any amount of support that we can add to this particular call to arms for the industry, I'm 100% behind it.
Absolutely. And I completely agree with the pair of you. And the only thing I can do to add to that in my usual style is just throw another stat into the mix.
Nice.
And yeah, I think in terms of the points you've raised, Rachel, in terms of how, you know, the independent ad tech side of things can, you know, is working and should work in terms of addressing this. At the moment, we've got, you know, the state where these verification providers, their profits from Open Programmatic IS, for example, has gone up 30% in their last quarter. And we've heard from publishers that their revenue is down 40%. Publishers are the ones that have been probably hurt the most through the third-party cookie era. And it's obviously not right that they're the ones now taking further flak from that. So to kind of build on that in a further question, what action are we likely to see from the industry, whether it be the publishers, whether it be publishing groups such as Ozone Project, as you've mentioned, or from, you know, the independent ad tech side and how they're regulated? What action could we possibly see to potentially redress this balance?
That's a super interesting question, Matt. I was thinking as I was reading this article about the state of IP as it applies to the digital publishing world, because it's not a new thing that digital publishers' IP has been compromised by transactions and life on the internet, whether it's just out and out plagiarism or their content being repositioned or reused by others, never mind these data scraping practices that we're talking about here. You know, don't forget that, you know, the Australian government entered into a pretty long and fairly bitter battle with the likes of Google and at the time Facebook on their use of publisher, journalistic originally authored content and not returning any of the revenue that was being made on advertising back to those publishers. So, you know, intellectual property law needs to be strengthened, in my opinion, around this particular area. And so it would be really good if there were some steps taken to create or, you know, either strengthen existing legal boundaries around intellectual property rights for digital publishers, or if they don't exist, to extend those intellectual property rights to cover this particular area, because very often we don't see action taken until there's a fear of litigation. So that could be one area that I could imagine that this would go off into. And then there's also the very strong moral argument that Harriet put forward, which is, what the actual are you doing? Like, what? I understand that you're protecting your diverse monetization strategy, dear ad tech vendor, but find another way to do it. And, you know, as a group of professionals in this industry, I think, you know, the AOP's open letter was also calling for everybody to come together and discuss this in an open and transparent way. So I appreciate, you know, some of my views have been very strong in this particular conversation. So I'm not, you know, trying to start an argument, but I do think this needs to be talked about at the most senior level across all organisations within the industry, and we need to agree to play nicely. But whatever it takes to force people to do that also needs to be put in place.
Yeah, absolutely. Strong arguments, but very, very well meant and absolutely necessary, in my opinion, at least.
Call to arms.
Exactly. We'll move on to the second part of the podcast now, where we find out more from Harriet about the work at Conscious Ad Network and, yeah, essentially what you're focusing on for 2023. So to start off, Harriet, if you know, listeners are unfamiliar with Conscious Ad Network, how basically introduce the company and what they do?
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. So Conscious Advertising Network, we're a voluntary coalition of around 150 organisations. We have some of, you know, Britain's best loved brands as part of us. We have people like Nationwide. We have kind of British Gas. We have Scottish and Southern Energy, for example. We have you know, a combination of agencies, large and small, everyone from kind of small independents, right up to the big kind of holding companies. We've literally just welcomed IPG Media Brands and Dentsu, for example. But we also have a group of civil society groups who are part of us. And they represent everything from kind of, I guess, anti-racism, anti-hate kind of organisations. We have climate charities who are part of us as well. And the idea is that we bring together this kind of unusual coalition because, you know, fixing some of the problems that have sprung up, you know, around hate, misinformation, children's wellbeing that we've discussed today, require a really diverse set of skills and you know, kind of knowledge in order to kind of get to the root of the problem. And if we as advertisers try to fix stuff, we'll get so far. But if we combine that with the really kind of deep knowledge that some of these groups have about the issues that we're trying to fix, then in fact, you know, we're going to get to a problem, a solution a lot quicker. So we've got 7 manifestos, and I always forget them. You can find them on our website, but they cover everything from informed consent through to hate speech, mis- and disinformation, climate, diversity, equality, and inclusion, for example. And, you know, and in each of those, basically what we've done is we've mapped all of the initiatives that exist that we can find, and we fill in the gaps where initiatives have been created by credible bodies like the UN, for example. You know, in our hate speech manifesto, we use a definition that was created by the UN to help everyone understand what it is and where the lines are. And the idea is these manifestos act as kind of signposts. So our members, when they sign up, they can audit their media spend against they can audit their operations against these manifestos, and then work out, you know, kind of where the areas for improvement are. And I guess, you know, we exist to break the link between advertising and harmful content, and actually to promote this healthy media ecosystem that we've talked about a little bit.
And are you finding, Harriet, that there are some brands and advertisers that are coming to you to be part of the network that you wouldn't necessarily, you know, that you may have struggled to get the attention of in, you know, previously? I'm just imagining, off the back of everything that we've discussed on the podcast today, that a lot of the issues that, you know, that make up your manifesto are just so much more prominent now than they were a few years ago in the sort of mind of the average consumer. So is that causing brands to be, to want to do a lot more than they ever have wanted to do before to participate in some form of consciousness when it comes to directing their advertising spend?
Yeah, absolutely. So we soft launched, or we kind of had our first meeting on following the Times investigation from quite a long time ago that found advertising on kind of terrorist and extremist content. And that kicked off a big industry-wide conversation. We had our first meeting on the day that Keith Weed, who was then kind of CMO of Unilever, stood up and said the online space has become so toxic that, you know, I'm really considering where we're advertising. And, you know, since then, I think the conversation has only kind of grown and really mainstreamed. I think what we saw through COVID with the medical mis- and disinformation that was out there, I think that bumps the industry up to a whole new level of concern and understanding about some of the roles it's playing. And absolutely, you know, we've had more organisations, I think, sign up in the last year than we have, in the years previously, and much bigger organisations, because this conversation has really, really mainstreamed. And what we're finding is that there's brands who are essentially signing up, and then they are saying, right, we want our agencies to be part of this, because the mechanism that we say is that, kind of brands and agencies should be putting up the principles of these manifestos in the RFPs that go out. And so kind of changing that kind of supply chain in general. And so absolutely, I think it's, we're seeing more and more really engaged members as well who, you know, are kind of seeing the Cannes manifestos as really as, you know, potential advantage and a way to do business very, very differently and as a selling point to their clients. And that was, you know, that was always the intention. I think we talked about the moral imperative to do some of these things. There's also an incredibly strong commercial imperative to, you know, to make sure that you're placing advertising in a way that's representative. You know, representative advertising sells more, it's more effective, you know, to be making sure that we're actually kind of contributing to this healthy media ecosystem, because that will get us in front of new consumers. It will ensure that our information environment stays trusted in the longer term and things like that. So, yeah, it's been a real journey, but it's very different now to when we started.
Interesting. And I think, you know, in terms of, you know, conversations we've seen at Exchange Wire mature over the course of the last couple of years in particular, have been around ESG and, you know, that sustainability and diversity piece. How have you seen those factors evolve, and how do you think the industry will move that from kind of the awareness piece, which it has been for the last few years, onto more kind of, you know, action?
So I think what you've described represents a shift from, you know, in a previous life, I used to work in corporate sustainability. And, you know, I think often it was used to be seen as a nice to have. So, you know, you'd have, or, you know, it was about avoiding risk. So, you know, you'd have your corporate sustainability team and they would probably sit within an organization and be quite isolated and, you know, pester everyone once a year for a sustainability report, kind of the data. And what we've seen is a huge mindset and cultural shift in the way that, you know, kind of sustainability, ESG, these kind of factors kind of play out within business. And I think that that's incredible to see. You know, you've had Unilever kind of, I think, you know, kind of completely kind of couple their corporate ambitions with their sustainability ones. We've seen, we've seen the real kind of growth of ESG and then the backlash in the States as well, obviously. But essentially, I think what that change is all about is that it makes good business sense to do this stuff. So by considering brand safety, and going way beyond brand safety, by the way, because, you know, the conscious advertising piece is much more about leadership than it is about compliance. You know, you are not only kind of avoiding risk, but as I said to you before, you're also potentially improving the effectiveness of your advertising by thinking about these things in a different way. You know, we talk a lot about the degradation within the sustainability space. We talk about the degradation of ecosystems, and we generally talk about the degradation of natural ecosystems. We're starting to talk about the degradation of information ecosystems with what we're seeing now. And I think that's also a big kind of business risk that needs to be more incorporated into some of these spaces. So we are having conversations, or certainly in spaces, and you know, for reasons of good business, as opposed to this being a nice to have. And that's been a massive cultural shift. And I think that, you know, long may it continue.
And are you seeing, that's super interesting, Harriet, are you seeing then as well that some brands are able to sort of come forward with some, you know, some hard sort of data and stats around to prove that very point, to say, we know since we've started shifting our advertising strategy to something that is speaking to a wider and more diverse audience, you know, we've sold more units, we've seen this kind of uptick in some of our activity. Are we starting to see that happen?
Yeah, so there's some great studies out there that show that more representative advertising, for example, you know, not only helps you reach more consumers, but makes those consumers who feel represented within your adverts much more likely to not only purchase your product, but, you know, kind of keep, kind of maintain more brand loyalty towards you in the longer term. We see, if you can look on Brand Advance's website to see, just how, kind of appearing in community media can actually expand your audience and really, kind of increase the effectiveness of your advertising with those audiences. And that was born out of the fact that, I think lots of organizations inadvertently block entire communities' worth of media. So LGBTQ+ content a couple of years ago, lots of LGBTQ+ kind of outlets were closing down because they just couldn't get the advertising revenue because we've got things like, you know, kind of gay or lesbian on your block list. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's the output from all of that. So this kind of conscious media investment is, and the kind of, you know, the conscious, you know, making sure that your creative is as representative as the audience that are viewing it, you know, has been shown to be more effective. And I think also if you couple that with, avoiding the brand damage that comes if you're appearing on, you know, kind of content that appears in investigations in the Times, for example. I think, you know, you can also add that in there as a kind of wider business saving.
It's fantastic, isn't it? Because just as a, you know, just as a sort of a general consumer, I've really noticed that advertising campaigns have become so much more diverse over the last couple of years. And thank God, it's about time. You know, I actually think that the average person is absolutely going to respond to advertising completely differently if they feel as though it's representing real life as opposed to constantly modeled perfection. I just, you know, I know the science behind that creates desire, makes you want to buy stuff, all the rest of it. But there's also something really beguiling about advertising that feels real. And yeah, it's great. Let's see more of it.
And I think it can have, you know, advertising is, there was a big conference that runs over the years called Mirrors or Movers. You know, kind of, do we reflect society or do we move society on? And frankly, you know, advertising has always played a role in kind of cultural narratives and kind of creating those. So the more that we see, you know, the more that we see you know, different body shapes and different you know, kind of cultures in our adverts, the more we actually normalize that diversity, and the more that we actually kind of, I think, help people. Well, I mean, we sell products essentially, but, you know, we do also tell stories, and the richness of the stories that we tell can have a cultural impact as well. And I think that's really important to think about as we're, you know, as we're creating the stuff that we create.
Definitely, because it still creates trends. You know, advertising has been responsible for creating trends, you know, throughout history. And I still think you can do that. In fact, the benefit, the upside, is that you can create more trends in a much more varied and diverse environment. And that's good for everybody, basically.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're always obsessed with the kind of, I guess, the latest generation and what they think and feel. And if you look into, you know, kind of studies around Gen Z, they are very, very different to generations who've come before, and they do expect brands to represent their to reflect them. And so, you know, if we're going to be obsessed with the next generation, then you know, it's a good. I guess it's important that we represent them in our ads too.
Yeah.
100%. Unfortunately, that brings us just about out of time. But Harriet, it's been absolutely fascinating to listen to you and have you on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you both as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you. And Rachel, glad to hear your very strong opinions as ever.
And my very strong Australian accent. It's back.
Absolutely. Long may it stay. Thank you all ever so much for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.